And he said, look, you know more about depression than anybody on the planet, which was generous. He goes, there's a logic to what you want to do. I know I can do it safely. So something to do is to put yourself in the position of, if this is somebody that you personally cared about, knowing what you know, knowing what I can do, knowing that if it doesn't go according to plan, we turn it off and take it out. And he felt confident about that. Would you do it? And the answer was yes. I mean, that's what I remember. That was a moment that I really realized you can have an idea, but that surgeons are amazing people because they go that extra step.
Welcome to Stimulating Brains.
Hello and welcome back to Stimulating Brains. Today I will talk with Helen Myberg, who does not need an introduction in this field, but is the director of the Center for Advanced Circuit Therapeutics at Mount Sinai. Of course, we will talk about her landmark paper together with Andres Lozano in 2005 in Neuron that put depression onto the map of the brain simulation, but we'll also cover different topics that go into the past, a bit similar as in the last episode, but also into the many inventions that the Myberg Lab has put into our field over the last decade.
I've told you I'd love to talk also a bit about the past, your past or your education, and you know, who stuck out, what were the experiences, and who were the mentors that stuck out.
Okay, so you know, it's interesting trying to kind of put a reverse lens on your life and look to see some kind of consistent roadway or some kind of pattern so that you can say I kind of knew where I was going, as opposed to a very ill-formed idea that really was not an idea. I mean, I had grew up in a family where my father was a practicing physician, but my mother's brother was an academic nuclear medicine physician. So he was both a scientist practitioner. And he was really an extraordinary scientist, but actually switched to medicine. And I watched his kind of tension between being a scientist, and that's where he wanted to be. He was actually doing PET scanning before PET scanning was PET. And so I would hang out with him in the lab and kind of play with Geiger counters. When I was in college, I would go down and he was doing things with the neurosurgeon. And so I had exposures that I didn't even know were relevant, but were quite impactful. So from an influential point of view, we did an experiment in my junior year of college where we did the original Olson Milner hypothalamic intracranial self-stim and conditioned rat to bar press for reward. And I can't say that grabbed me, but that was certainly an eventful experiment of 4 years of university. And a similar class, I wrote a paper on lobotomy. And again, why? Because something about the idea you could damage the brain and fix it was such an oxymoron. In medical school, you know, it became very clear I liked behavior. I thought I liked psychiatry because of the problems. And then realized I totally hated the language. And as I tried to figure out, well, how can I study this another way, I just thought, that's not how it works. Here's the decision tree. And it was like, okay, there's a jump here that behavioral neurology is kind of a compromise. And I did a rotation from Los Angeles, went to Boston and had a month with Mom and Dad. And because I had read his work, then I knew that was at least taking a descriptive but organized approach to complex behavior. And again, this was really at the very early days of clinical imaging. So when I got to Hopkins, it was to learn the methodology of PET scanning. So I was postdoc, but I was in nuclear medicine. So I left neurology to essentially train again as a clinician scientist and did a, you know, equivalent of a PhD thesis on opiate receptor imaging. So I, again, had a mentor in nuclear medicine. I was mostly doing epilepsy. But on the side, work I'd read by Bob Robinson in stroke depression and Sergio Starkstein were on another floor. So again, piecing together my psychiatry interests, but they had no access to the scanners. I was doing epilepsy and doing receptor mapping and was in the radiology department and was able to do both. And it was, again, a very influential and uncomfortable conversation with my neurology mentor from medical school, Leslie Weiner at USC in Los Angeles. Went to visit him and he asked what I was doing and said, I told him, and he goes, no, you know, what are you studying? And he was the one who painfully reminded me that, look, I wasn't a receptor pharmacologist and I wasn't an opiate physiologist and I wasn't a nuclear chemist or a physicist. And so I kept getting kind of slammed, or at least how it felt. He said, you're a neurologist. What do you want to know about? What do you want to study? Is it epilepsy? Is it depression? You're doing so many things. What do you want to know about? And do that. And you'll do it with one method. And then you'll get a question, that method won't work. And you'll adopt another method. Yeah. So pick the topic, because that's what you do. Don't pick the method. And that was probably, among everything that anybody ever said to me, the most valuable piece of advice.
Yeah, so start with the topic, not with the method, is I think great advice, I must say. Ask a research question or ask a research topic, and that makes a lot of sense. I could guess now that this and other experiences, but also a lot of the literature and experiments you did in the imaging world at some point led to the milestone that surely was or culminated in the 2005 Neuron paper, where you did the first modern day deep brain, or the first deep brain simulation in depression patients. And I remember vividly a keynote you gave at OHBM in 2013 in Seattle. You said something like, what do you do if you stick an electrode into a person's brain? You hope all goes well. Maybe you can share with us a bit these very initial excitements, but also, you know, tensions that were there. How did it feel like? How were the first experiences back then?
So, you know, again, you know, opportunity and timing, and enough knowledge to either be dangerous or feel justified. And I was very fortunate to actually be in Toronto. And at the time that it just kind of seemed there was a question to ask and there was a technology to use and there was a neurosurgeon who liked to and could do novel things. And again, if we had not spent the previous, you know, 5-6 years working on the interaction between this Area 25 subclosal cingulate and its kind of apparent hijacking of the cortex, and we're conceptualizing that these systems were yoked. And this, again, was pre-default mode. Yep. This was pre-fMRI, even though these concepts were actually running in parallel and obviously have beautifully converged and been mutually informative. But that at the point where if you need to drug or drive down this area because it seemed in all the experiments to be associated with a necessary effect for depression patients to recover regardless of the treatment, everything that was known about DDS and Parkinson's at the time was that all you did was block where you were stimulating. So again, naive, wrong, partly wrong. true enough to justify the experiment. If, in fact, we had known how it really worked, I probably wouldn't have felt comfortable to do it. So again, enough knowledge to justify. I knew where we wanted to go. I knew what I wanted to have happen. I knew that things could go wrong because I also knew what the connections were of that region, and I figured we would have problems with autonomic instability in the operating room or some untoward subcortical problem, but that we could turn it off, so we could watch for that.
Yeah.
But there, this is, again, that moment of theory, third person, design it, know in principle it would work, have a surgeon, you know, then learn that surgeons will do anything, I mean, because they can. They take very knowledgeable this. But again, if they can put these electrodes pretty much anywhere they want, and this was not a hard target, even though we didn't have a very well-formed target, but we were close enough, yeah. Or at least we thought being close enough would be good enough.
Yeah.
And as we planned it all out and got funding and had permission, that's when this piece kind of became, God, we're really going to do this.
Yeah.
And I think then is the point where you think you've got the roadmap and the blueprint and what you're going to do and finally get a patient. And then it really fits as what will happen if something goes wrong.
Sure.
And this is where, again, you don't do these things alone. And even though everybody wants to do something new and push the envelope, Andres Lozano was incredibly helpful. And I remember a conversation with him where he basically sat me down and said, because I said, look, I don't know what I'll do if we hurt this person. You know, again, she didn't have options, but we certainly don't want to do harm. You know, and there are complications, as remote as they are, of putting electrodes in the brain. Invading the brain has risks. And he said, look, you know more about depression than anybody on the planet, which was generous. He goes, there's a logic to what you want to do. I know I can do it safely. So something to do is to put yourself in the position of, if this is somebody that you personally cared about, knowing what you know, knowing what I can do, knowing that if it doesn't go according to plan, we turn it off and take it out. And he felt confident about that.
Yeah.
Would you do it? And the answer was yes. And he goes, so let it go. You know, it will be there. And it'll evolve in front of us, or, you know, something like that. I mean, that's what I remember. And that was a moment that I really realized you can have an idea, but that surgeons are amazing people because they go that extra step.
Sure.
And I know when I talk to my psychiatry colleagues, they always say, boy, you know, we were all studying this, but you decided actually to do it.
Mm.
I couldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And I look at it as, you know, I had tried to be a neurosurgeon. So again, back to, you know, how funny, how does the world work? You know, I started doing nuclear medicine because my uncle did. I ended up finding this hybrid place because I didn't have a home. I tried to be a neurosurgeon as one of my choices and settled for neurology because I didn't like operating myself.
Yeah.
Spend all that time.
Sure.
And then X number of years later, I'm telling a neurosurgeon what I want them to do. And actually, the amazing thing is they're happy to do it. And so it is a mosaic. It is a hybrid.
Yeah.
And that you need all these pieces. And that I couldn't have made that last decision myself because I would have, I actually am a risk-averse person.
Mm.
I think that's why I did a lot of imaging. I mean, if you get me in there, I'm as dogged as anyone. But left to my natural ways, I'm pretty risk averse. So I didn't see it as a risky experiment.
Yeah.
Not just because, well, it's not me putting the electrode in. It should have worked.
Yeah.
If anything that I knew was true. So I did that computation. But I still, right before, I was terrified.
Sure.
You know, I was terrified, not for the experiment, I was terrified for the patient.
Of course. Yeah.
And this is where, like any physician's relationship with the patient, you have to both be honest, but you actually have to protect them.
Yeah.
And then you have to hold in yourself your worry and just know that you've got a room of people that are there for the patient and first and the experiment second, and it'll go how it goes, and you just need to be adaptive if you need to. And luckily, it turned out even better than I could have hoped, because all we really wanted in that operating room that first day was to get it where we wanted it and to have nothing bad happen.
Yeah.
The fact that things happened in the OR when we were looking for bad things to stop turned out to be really interesting and good things was just an absolute bonus and the start of everything.
You were in the operation room, I assume, or I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
How was that moment to test?
So the operating room is really interesting because there's lots of people running around.
Yeah.
The patient is awake on the bed and, draped and attached to the stereotactic head frame. We would plan the surgery. So Dr. Lozano and Dr. Clement Hamani, his postdoc at the time, the three of us kind of used our approximate maps, not like the kind of maps that you use or even that we use now. I mean, it was really eyeballing a pretty low resolution MRI and basing it on our PET scan blobs. So it was kind of amazing in retrospect.
Yeah.
But that my job was to be on the non-scrub side of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk to the patient, and Andres and Clement were on the sterile side.
Yeah.
And when we got ready to test, because the electrodes were in, it was really, the instruction to the patient, because this is the ultimate placebo-controlled experiment, because we don't know what's going to happen, and the patient doesn't know what's going to happen. So it's a virgin experience for everybody.
Yeah.
And as we started on the first contact and went at very low current, and we decided we'd do high frequency like Parkinson's because we wanted to block the activity, supposedly. We just would ramp it up, and first contact, we got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So then we moved to the next contact, and we tried it again. I can't remember if it was the second one or the third one. Not much is happening, and we didn't want anything to happen because we figured we'll use the location to decide how to stimulate, because this is going to be a chronic effect, because depression is a chronic treatment. And we get to one of the contacts, we start to ramp up the current, we get to about, five milliamps, and all of a sudden the patient starts to describe that she feels something. And it's kind of like, well, what is it? And she felt calm. And, you're kind of figuring out, is she falling asleep? Does it feel like Valium? We started asking her questions. She got very kind of short with me. And she says, look, you're trying to get me to describe the difference between a laugh and a smile. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's going, how do I explain it? She goes, the void is gone.
Void.
And I'm kind of going, what's a void? And all of a sudden, there's this descriptions of things that had gone away that she had never described as being present.
Mm.
And then we turned down the current, and she goes, oh, I must have been imagining it.
Wow.
And then we tried it again, and then she started to get more descriptive and more metaphorical. And it was interesting because instead of what we might have done, which was sit and spend a lot of time, we presumed that it would be like Parkinson's, that, gee, this is good.
Mm.
Check the other contacts. Some contacts were better than others.
Yeah.
But there was clearly localizable change in behavior.
Yeah.
But it was extraordinary in that it was transient and subtle and metaphorical, and clearly not the generation of euphoria, but the generation of relief.
Yeah.
And how do you describe the moment when you no longer hurt?
Yeah.
That is an ethereal thing. And as a non-psychiatrist, as a non-philosopher, this was a spiritual thing to watch. I mean,
I can imagine.
Only because we looked at my notes, had this experience with many, many patients, had to get into the weeds of what does it feel like.
Mm-hmm.
You become sort of, it's not even armchair psychiatrist, because this isn't part of what they talk to psychiatrists about either. So it's another example of the language of psychiatry, which I had rejected, wasn't even adequate to characterize what we were seeing. And we spent the last number of years trying to figure out what are we seeing, because it's so fundamental. Yeah. But we saw it that first day early on, and I don't even think we appreciated what we were seeing.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty salient memory. And that's when you realize that this is really hard, but that it's worth doing, because those patients we have now, have come out of this state, and while it's not immediately well, when you get people well with this device, it's long lasting. I mean, like years, not 6 months, not a year. Where now we have people 10, 12, 13 years with the device.
Yeah.
And so how can you not want to try to figure out what that is?
And I think from that, the rest was history, but there was not everything was done yet. And I told you a few times already that I'm always amazed if I look back. Your lab somehow often was the first to do things that I sometimes think about, we should do that. Usually you've already done it. So a list of some things, for example, you used M&I space coordinates instead of ACPC coordinates in your papers or for planning. You used, of course, PET activation maps, fMRI activation maps to inform targets. Then you also went on to use tractography for analysis, and then later with StimVision also in the OR for seeing which bundles you want to hit. And now we met in Stanford. I heard you're using segmented leads for segregation of the internal capsule. And I even haven't mentioned the electrophysiology part, right? So you also do a lot on that. And of course, it's not all you. You lead a center and so on. But what are the strategies to use all these techniques and to integrate things?
Well, I think it comes down to something my father told me, continues to tell me, that he observes. He goes, it's really important to ask the right question.
Yeah.
You know, one. And I think, you know, being driven by observation, which comes down to the patient, is fundamental. Mm. But I think that you surround yourself with people that can help you answer the question.
Yeah.
So it's, the only thing I will take credit for actually knowing how to do myself is doing PET scanning.
Yeah.
Okay. I know how to do that. I know every in and out of those methods.
Yeah.
But now I kind of feel not like an imposter, but the fact that I know the question, but I know that the tools have become way more complicated than one person or one team can do. And how can we leverage the community? You know, one of the things I so admire about your lab and your way of thinking and really resonate with it is your generosity, and I think it reflects, you know, our respective ages, that young people are I think are more open, and I appreciate that. Like to think I always was, but probably wasn't. But how do you take information that everyone is collecting and put it together? Mm. I always did a lot of reading, so I kind of voraciously consume the non-human primate anatomy literature, probably driven as a neurologist, but looking for associations, oftentimes that didn't exist because I needed to justify a decision.
Yeah.
So now I realize that the questions, if I'm trying to solve a problem and I've got an unknown, I've got to have an equation to solve it. And the equations in this metaphor are tools. So if now timing is important and I can't get timing with the tool the way I'm doing it, then I've got to find another tool, which means I've got to get people interested in the problem, which gets back to ask a good question, because then people want to help you.
Yeah.
Now, part of, it's not just, you know, being a good salesman. I think everyone resonates with this problem. The idea that you would be in a state of mental pain and not be able to get out, what is that, is universal. And it can be metaphorical, like how we're stuck now in our current kind of purgatory state of not, you know, the unknown.
You mean the COVID situation?
COVID.
Yeah.
And, but that everybody that hears a story, and at every stage of my work, is about everybody knows somebody who's depressed.
True.
People have friends that have committed suicide, or they've been sick themselves, or a family member, or a friend, or a colleague. It is something that people suffer from. I don't personally have depression. So why do I study it? I don't know. It was interesting and hard, but fundamentally seemed neurological.
Yeah.
But back to your other point, I think that as the question becomes, it's getting an answer, and it isn't like I believe in the theory of everything, but that for this problem, it seems as though there are pieces that can be solved, and the only way they're solved is by teamwork and trying to integrate the pieces.
Yeah.
And it's hard in our current academic settings because everybody needs to move up their personal food chain, just like I did. And so how does one facilitate other people's success for what they want to do by seducing them in some ways to be interested in your problem while also letting them be the lead? And it's a very complex, constant, iterative thing where you're not controlling. And I'm old. I want to solve it. I want to solve this problem so I can go do something else that might be fun. You know, my husband would like it that I did something else for a while.
Yeah.
And I tell him maybe, you know, this is important, if only to finish a chapter to rest. And now I have a team where, you know, we're trying to integrate, and it's back to involving neurology. So I've kind of come full circle in a,
I was fortunate enough to see, I think, two talks of you at Harvard University in 2016. And I think one focused more on deep brain simulation and imaging, and the other one more on individual patients and experiences you made with depression patients that you treated. And I think both talks were brilliant. And it really showed the two sides here of being both an academic researcher, but also a caring physician. And I think it was also that talk that where you mentioned the rounds you did with Norman Geschwind and so on. So these people apparently influenced how you thought about the brain. And you just mentioned that the terms that psychiatry used, that you didn't see them in good light. So how did that shape how you would approach clinical translational questions?
So I think, you know, I mean, it's long-winded, but, you know, informative, you know, maybe. But that I really, as I started studying depression, I was a voyeur. So one of the things about imaging is that to be really an expert, one has to go deep in the method. And in some ways, you almost have to approach the problem from the third person. And that for many years, I mean, really starting at Hopkins, where I was in multiple departments, and my clinical work was general neurology, and my research work was highly technical and on depression, I basically had a split life. And as I changed institutions, I was trying to merge them because I was studying depression and Parkinson's, actually. My first grants were on that, where I said, well, you know, I'll be in the clinic, I'll see movement disorder patients, and I'll be able to study depression right there. And I found that was a total mess because the patients were extremely sick. You couldn't isolate out the part you wanted to do. It wasn't clinical research. I was trying to do mapping, and it just wasn't ready. And so I basically split my activities between my first-person interaction with patients from my third-person mapping experiment. And that worked. So I had to have very, very competent clinical collaborators and to trust them because I couldn't get the patients myself. And that was both a good thing and a bad thing, because I could focus on just the science. But I had an episode happen when I was doing some studies in Texas. I was in Peter Fox's lab. I was one of the first scientists when the Brain Imaging Center, the Research Imaging Center started.
That was 91 in Texas, San Antonio, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was pre Organization for Human Brain Mapping. I mean, this was, you know, sort of, I'm sort of a dinosaur, but, and I wasn't even first generation dinosaur, sort of second generation, but I would go down, I would do all the injections myself. I would do the scans with the tech, myself, and I would meet the patient. I wouldn't screen the patients. I'd meet the patient. And it was one, we were doing, you know, a group of patients and studying, antidepressant effects, but we still had a PET scan study of people just kind of mapping variability. And I met this older man that had a very, very bad depression. He was about the sickest patient I had seen coming through. And it really struck me with his suffering and also how many things he had failed. Enough so that actually I had been giving a talk at Mass General. And I was in the Ether Dome in this big historic place and everybody making the fuss. And I spent time with the neurosurgeons and I was really interested in all of their studies on cingulotomy. Again, going back to my college interests, but, you know, depression and imaging, you run into cingulotomy and psychosurgery pretty fast. Yeah. And I took it upon myself to try to get this man referred to the cingulotomy program. I'd spent time with those people in my visit.
Yeah.
And he got rejected, and he committed suicide.
Oh, my.
And it would be remiss of me to say that those things are connected, but they sort of are. And the reason he was rejected was because of a 20-year prior alcohol use. And what suddenly crystallized, perhaps through that case, was the idea, this is no joke. We can sit in math and we can think we know about how the brain works and this circuit does X or Y, goes up or down, and fight among ourselves of what method we're going to use.
Yep.
At the end of the day, if the work doesn't lead to making a difference for people, we're playing for a living.
Sure.
And it became pretty clear that I was playing for a living because it was safe. And I didn't know it at the time because I was just frustrated and sad that that wasn't a good enough reason. And again, far be it from me to tell another institution what their inclusion or exclusion criteria is for a procedure. But it in retrospect said, we've got to use what we learn to affect change.
Yeah.
And if the status quo isn't good enough, can we direct our research in a way that we learn about how the brain works? And I think that that is noble, and that's what many people do extremely well. My personal conflicts are about how do I take my intuition and my clinical training and ask questions using these technologies in a way that can affect clinical change.
Yes.
And that wasn't like I said at that moment, light bulb, I'm going to do DBS. I was trying to reconcile, how can you make a lesion in these areas? Why does that work? And how does disinhibition work? And so all of these pieces are like this big puzzle of which you assume all the pieces are in the box.
Yeah.
You don't know if they are. There's no picture on the top of the box to tell you how you're assembling the pieces. They're kind of grabbing them haphazardly, and you're kind of trying to hope they fit together. Mm. And that was just kind of a section of, I think, a big puzzle that actually probably was pretty salient and pretty important, even though I didn't realize how important it was at the time.
There's a great passage in this book by Lone Frank, The Pleasure Shock. Actually, I really like the book, to be honest. And I think back then, in your early, very early days in UCLA, you also had the opportunity to be in the lab of Irvin and Mark, if that's correct, at least around the same.
Yeah. No, I worked in a lab down the hall.
Okay. And I think in that book, she basically takes up the story that the Terminal Man movie came out based on the book by Michael Crichton. And Crichton had done an internship with Frank and Irvin at Boston City Hospital in the 60s. And basically the book ruminated one story of one patient that was inspired by a real patient, and they were treating violent behavior in epilepsy patients back then. And you experienced demonstrations on the street of the counterculture, and even apparently were hit by demonstrators trying to enter the building. I think she wrote, one of those who received some lumps that day was a young, ambitious student by the name of Helen Myberg.
That was, I forgot I had told her that story because, and again, you forget all of the influences, but, I read Violence in the Brain, that, and then when realized that part of the team was actually there, I actually worked for the wife of one of the neurosurgeons, Crandall. And, and so when I would go into the building, suddenly there were all these protesters, because of the violence center. And so it was kind of, trying to duck through, and you felt like you're crossing a picket line, and was sort of an irony. But again, it's like I knew about it there, again, very third person. But what a funny coincidence, because actually when I was a resident, there were two papers I read that were probably influential. One was the Brain paper in 83, I think, of Bob Robinson on stroke depression. And the other was in the New England Journal, which was a group conference statement about whether or not epilepsy patients were violent. And so that summary about that, and Engel was the lead, and Engel had been at UCLA when I was in college. And so this whole notion of purposeful violence influencing, in epilepsy patients. It's kind of like what goes on now with, schizophrenics are violent and so all of these things kind of hang together in our subconscious in the most interesting of ways. I mean, I actually did a lot of medical legal work arguing against that, brain issue. That you can't use a scan to determine culpability in a crime. And I realized that was really going back to epilepsy patients having automatism, that could be the basis of purposeful violence. I mean, so it is really interesting how there are threads that go back when I was 16 years old.
Would you say that your current decisions, like, did you learn from these times where the culture was against, psychosurgery and so on? And how can we prevent this from happening again? Günther Deutsch mentioned to me that the best thing we can do to prevent this happening again would be to document the cases as good as we can, right? Our successes, and be as scientific as possible, of course.
No, I think that, I look at Moniz, and I loved, there's a small museum at a small hospital in Lisbon where he has all his papers and his contraptions. They also have all the angiograms. It's really magnificent little museum. And that you read the history. I think we have to read history, and whether or not it's making sure that we cite people properly in our own papers, nothing's original. There's just a different orientation, again, because of the tool. And I'm guilty of this too. I've looked at who did what and is the location of where we went and our logic. I mean, our logic was our logic and wasn't previous logic. But that you can go back and even look at Ed Friedman's work and Moniz's work. The only criticism you could say is lack of documentation. And they didn't look to balance. Did they do what they said they did, and what tools did they have to know? And I think the same is true of with Robert Heath, that, even to have the institution hide the data, to make it so difficult. I mean, what Lorne did is really important to the historical record. And it isn't just commentary through the lens of patients that were harmed, which is also very important, but that to actually get in the head of what was someone's motivation then. What was happening? What was the field doing? We can't have a 2020 view on what was going on in the 50s. People were locked up, chained up, being given insulin, being put into comas, being tied up you know, it was a bad time without treatments. And I think that he had a hypothesis. He was testing it. People lost sight of that because he kind of like went sideways. When he got into believing things that weren't evidence-based, were not hypothesis-driven, well, if I can stick a probe in anywhere, I can do whatever I want, he got lost. Mm. But I think when you get to his fundamental intent that the septal area was important in schizophrenia, it doesn't matter if now we know that that was a simplistic idea. The logic was impeccable.
Sure.
The data was there. You look at those pictures and it's sobering to realize we're using the same bloody device that he was using then, and he didn't have four companies helping. And you can't have hubris about what that must have been like. You can only grieve the idea that he lost his way because he bought his own hype.
Yeah.
And whatever else went on, which the record is hard to parse. So I think for us, you have to be honest about your motivation and your logic. I think we have protections that they don't have. Sometimes it can seem onerous. The levels of regulation. I like to say that if I had realized what regulatory hoops I would have to go through in the United States,
sure,
if I had my idea and done it in the United States instead of Canada, I probably would have given up because I didn't really think it was going to work, and this was too much trouble. It was just dumb luck to have been in Canada where we could test the idea and then go deep. But I think this is all about, no one says this is easy, and there's nothing wrong with having an idea, testing it, as long as you do it safely, and it turns out it was a harebrained idea and it doesn't work. So you stop.
Yeah.
It's not about your own ego. It's about, or about money. It's about getting the right answer. And most ideas don't get anywhere, even when they're tested. So I look at the historic record and go, if we document,
sure,
we'll be okay. I expect if in 50 years, people will look back and go, you stuck what in people's brains?
Sure. Yeah.
Because we'll have tools that we don't do it this way. I mean,
sure,
but this is where we are. And
yeah,
and if anybody will care, then the record will be clear.
True.
And I don't lose a lot of sleep over it because I know we take a very deliberate point of view, and if you follow the data, the data will always set you free.
Sure, yeah. You know, maybe if you think about the world as a global consciousness, I feel currently it's really in depression because it ruminates about one topic, which is COVID, and it paralyzes the actions of people and of organs and of states and countries. This is the only topic, and it's a bit like, it really reminded me of depressive states in the brain somehow as well. I don't know if that's a good...
No, and keep ruminating, hoping you'll suddenly find a solution,
yes,
of truth, and not the certainty of it. It's a good metaphor. I've had the same thought because, I mean, I think there's a reason that maybe even how depression is conceptualized is just kind of wrong, you know, that it really is about, you know, not being able to state shift. And that's really all it is. I mean, we keep trying. I mean, there's a expression about, it's an Einstein expression, I think, repeating a mistake, you know, like hoping for a different solution.
Yeah.
So where's the balance between iteration is Bayesian and good versus iteration is just digging a hole deeper?
Well, now you're, since 2018, the director of the Center for Advanced Circuit Therapeutics at Mount Sinai in New York. So the integration, I think you mentioned, between neurosurgery, neuroradiology, but also, of course, neurology and psychiatry. If I understood correctly, in one building, or is that true, that you're close to each other now?
And so instead of having, I think, what everybody's familiar with, because everybody's got a multidisciplinary team that does this, the thing, though, is that they're virtual and that, you know, you get together and everyone does their part.
Yeah.
But in fact, one of the things I learned at Emory was that having collisions, not just, you know, around the coffee machine, but actually being able to be fluent in more than one language, at least, you know, to be able to get by, is done by having everybody in close proximity. And we couldn't quite get it at Emory. We tried. So we did it in our lab, but never accomplished it, despite some efforts. So in moving, part of the conditions of moving was to say, let's try it. You know, if I move, I want to live in neurosurgery.
Okay.
I want the people who do DBS in close proximity, not because I personally want to go back to studying non-motor problems and movement disorder, but why should we reinvent the wheel in parallel? Why should psychiatry DBS be answering fundamentally the same questions that neurology is doing? That's just a waste of time. And it turned out that Brian Capel, my surgeon in New York, not only was he fundamentally interested in depression himself, he also shared, and I think it's a common view of neurosurgeons, that you treat circuits, you don't treat diseases.
Yeah.
This is the luxury of the surgeons. They treat everything. But the thing is, if they behave as just a convergence point and not a convergence point on a wheel, that we really want to be having to where what neurology learns is fundamentally the same brain, and what psychiatry is studying is the same brain but just a different circuit, and that we can have reciprocal relationships. And so we have Martin Fugini, who's a psychiatrist that's interested in OCD, but he's also interested in compulsive and behaviors and non-motor behaviors in Parkinson's.
Yeah.
So he's an ideal partner in bridge. So even by just a few people that will share this point of view,
yeah,
and then imaging scientists like Yi-Sun Choi and electrophysiologists like Allison Waters, where they're open, even though their orientation has been to depression, their universe has been expanded to think about circuit therapeutics, but it can be enabled because otherwise they're just the sole practitioner of their expertise that we can leverage each other. Now, so we all live together in the same space. And if I realized how hard it was going to be, I'm not sure I would have done it, but then that's kind of what happened with the DBS experiment. I actually did it knowing it should have worked, but I never did the computation of what I would do if it actually did work. I hoped it would work, but I didn't actually play out the hand in my mind of what would happen if it really worked long term. And I think it's the same as this.
Yeah.
It's only rational. It's going back to Ross Valdestorini that, you know, psychiatry and neurology will merge because of imaging. They didn't merge. But they're merging actually because of neuromodulation. And they're not merging because of neuromodulation with non-invasive tools. Those are still totally separate. They merge when everybody has to meet in an operating room to do something. And it's sort of, I mean, I just thought about this. I mean, how ironic, you know, had I become a neurosurgeon, this would not have happened either. Because I would have been whatever kind of neurosurgeon I would have been. And maybe but I wouldn't have had the behavioral side of things to actually see these various components. So, but it's hard because you have three administrations, you have every department to deal with. You have the constant entropy of it pulling apart rather than pulling together. But I have administrative support in a way that at least when we fail, it will have been a valiant effort. And I think it won't evolve exactly how it is in my mind's eye, but then nothing ever does. So if you at least get a green light to be able to try it, as opposed to, no, it doesn't work like that. So, you know, it comes back to kind of three rules that, as I realized going backwards, were always the three rules. Now, the first question when someone says no is, well, is it illegal? You know? And then the second question is, well, is it physically impossible? And when you get through that gate, then the thing is, oh, you mean it's this hard, or we don't do it that way. Or, you know, you get back to don't be really rejection sensitive, look for a solution. And I think the new center is that way. I think the experiments have always been that way. I think career, you know.
And you've been an attending in urology and radiology, at least. And you've, of course, worked a lot with psychiatrists. And so that surely helps, right? Yeah.
But I think, you know, what the other thing I mean, from a more nihilistic point of view, the structure of medical education and training, each discipline now, I mean, again, when Dr. Balbastardini says they'll emerge, late 70s, we didn't know very much about anything in neuroscience. So it was easy to say, oh, these things will kind of go back into one hopper. Well, as you know, as a neurologist, neurology used to just do diagnosis. Now the treatments are extraordinary, and molecular biology is the center of the universe in neurology, you know, more than imaging. Whereas in psychiatry, it's also gotten very molecular. And psychiatry, to me, still doesn't embrace the brain model. It still holds on to the brain as a bowl of soup, you know, add a chemical, stir, I don't really need to know where. And it's much more interested in these molecular genes and the interaction of you know, all very interesting, but doesn't get into a fundamental principle of how the brain works. And again, you know, people are free to approach these complex problems however they want to do it. But to me, it's always been about get the basic architecture, the basic structure of the system, and then you can go deep. So I've always been kind of a lower resolution person.
It probably really goes back to, for a long time, we just didn't, as you mentioned, in the 70s, we didn't know too much about the brain, and we still don't. And I guess it was really the development of, you know, we have a software and a hardware, and it's fine to study just the software because we don't understand the hardware. And that's maybe how all this language developed. And now we're trying to fit it back together, but it doesn't fit.
So I have a new kind of working way. I mean, it's, you know, it's rationalization maybe, but it goes back actually to what we saw in the operating room with that first patient, which we had thought about. The data tells me now that basically maybe all DBS does is kind of reset the system.
Okay.
It's not broken. It's dysregulated. It's off the track.
Yeah.
There's something about kind of the electrical reset done from the very beginning, that one working hypothesis is that all it does is kind of cardiovert the brain, but in a very, very specific way. It's not ECT.
Yeah.
These are ECT failures. But that you reset the brain and then you actually maintain a pacemaker, and that the rest is rehab.
Yeah.
And it's the ultimate integration of everybody's right, just not at the same time.
Sure.
You cannot do psychodynamic psychotherapy. You can't even do behavioral activation, you know, classical psychiatric rehab, you know, therapy, if your brain doesn't work, any more than you can't kind of lift weights or run on a broken limb. And so the first thing you do is reset the bone, reset the system, open up the, you know, make the basic structure work. Mm-hmm. And then the timing becomes, how do you do graduated rehab?
Okay.
And trying to understand how rehab works is very different if you don't fundamentally know that the organ of interest or the bone isn't aligned.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have to deal with the fact that a surgeon perfectly fixes a broken bone, and a runner never goes exactly back to running the marathon at the same time that they did. But then there are people that you can fix their bone perfectly. You don't make them a runner.
Yeah.
And so the big thing about, we equally can't have that, because we've got these tools and they can do almost miraculous changes in these profoundly ill people. Yeah. It's necessary, but not sufficient. And if there was one example of the fact that we all need each other in the clinical neurosciences, it's that even with this kind of device, without a therapist or without rehab, people can't be who they could be. And so the machine is not enough. So everybody is right, just not at the same time.
Makes sense.
So order is important. So I'll be happy if I can just figure out what that reset thing is, because I think at the end of the day, that's probably all we do. But that's pretty important.
Speaking about that reset, that rings a bell about one last topic I wanted to dive into as well, which is the depression switch, which is, I think, your current model, or at least the model from recent papers that you now basically develop the CG25 simulation on. So my understanding is that there are three bundles at least. So the cingulum bundle, the forceps minor, and the uncinate fasciculus. Stimulating at that crossing site seems to be associated with good outcome. And you've now even migrated that into a prospective trial and have shown that if you really target these three structures, you get better rates of good clinical outcome.
Sure. So I think that, you know, fundamentally the old days were get some blobs, look up in a paper and see how they connect. And all we really did was reverse engineer with tractography this map. Mm-hmm. So in essence, just like the whole rest of the world, we've moved away from voxel-based analyses to network constructs. This is a structural network. And it's a convergence point between several known networks. Actually, there's a fourth component, which is harder to map with tractography, but there is the subcortical connections, because Area 25 projects to the raphe.
Yeah.
It projects to the nucleus accumbens. It projects to the anterior midline thalamus. And so the subcortical part may be actually fundamentally more important than the rest, a little harder to prove.
Yeah.
But I think that this idea of dynamics of networks is certainly where the whole field is now, and dynamical models. And when you think about the phenomenology of the reset in the operating room, the switch, it almost feels as though you're watching something that's dissynchronous or overly synchronous kind of either become phase locked or broken apart. It happens at a timing that can only be explained that way. And so obviously we can make inferences by looking at people who did better or not by what we were stimulating or not.
Yeah.
But that's very different from a causal model of what is necessary and sufficient even within our system.
Definitely.
And we've been, in our more recent work, we've been trying to track with these prototype devices what is Area 25 doing in its physiology. But obviously, we need ways to measure the rest of the brain.
Sure.
And behaviorally, we're trying to explore how can we leverage things by how people move or how their facial expression changes or the qualities that the psychiatrists infer from their exams, but that the network differences is how to actually look at that in a smart way is challenging, and we're leveraging every collaboration we've got. I mean, we learned a lot watching strategies that people did with epilepsy patients, where you can kind of brute force machine learn the whole brain. I think that gets part of the answer. I don't think that gets the answer. Okay. But even with, and you can't put people back easily in a scanner, in an fMRI scanner, although I know your group has, but one's got to be, again, smart. If it was easy, we'd be done already.
Yeah.
There are these technical limitations. But my instinct is you're watching how these overlearned patterns, these ruminative, these almost kind of just ground in patterns of these very sick people, you have to disrupt them and then you have to retrain them. And the question is which ones to retrain, and then how does dynamics across these networks change over time? And I think that there's early changes and there's late changes, and some may be enabled by the stimulator, and some really require either brute force rehab with a therapist, or maybe they need another place in the brain to stimulate. And I think that's, you know, something to keep us busy thinking about.
We met in Stanford. Brian Koppel mentioned that DBS in his brain really means disrupting an attractor state. And I think that's what you mean, right? So would you say there's an attractor state of depression that keeps this ruminating going, and the like low entropy, basically low freedom, low changing?
So I think, you know, and if I could retrain, it'd probably be as like a physicist to study this nonlinear dynamics, mm-hmm. because every time, like you just said, the phenomenology is of a stable local minimum.
Yeah.
That the first effects are really popping you into another actually unstable state. So the models of bistability are really most attractive,
yeah.
to really kind of describe the phenomenology. And then something over time moves you into a stable and more entropic state. I mean, I think, you know, the brain should intrinsically not be stuck in one subroutine.
Yeah.
And depression is like, you know, Groundhog's Day, the movie. You know, it's no matter what you do, the answer is the same. And whether or not you describe it as rumination, you keep looking for a solution and you keep getting the same answer. And that pretty much makes your predictions. You're very good at prediction.
Mm.
It just happens to be not going toward the goal.
Yeah, makes sense.
And DBS actually shifts you out of this local minimum, this pothole, this rut, and then actually you reestablish your entire environment, which really requires you to repopulate your life experience with a brain that will respond to the world in a more normal way. And there's something about the DBS that allows that new repertoire of world interactions to evolve. And, you know, that takes time, but maybe resetting that normal prediction error coding can happen is as simple as just a small alignment. And I think that would be, you know, just the best if in the end it turned out the DBS just was totally an enabler. And the rest, you know, look, you want to know what consciousness is, not my department. You know, you want to know how you learn or all the things that make life so incredibly amazing in human beings, who we are, and give all of us, you know, a lot of people things to study. Now, this just allows you to do that. And the patients say that. I mean, the patients will even tell you, look, you didn't give me anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you really want to hear that after all this work. And they go, no, you took something away.
Great.
And it became so hard to realize that life is just really hard. But at least I'm in the game. At least I can make my own mistakes because my brain isn't fighting with me. And that is so fundamentally at the core, I think, we as doctors want to do.
We want to
take away suffering. Sometimes that's giving a pill. Sometimes that's doing an operation.
Yeah.
But in essence, we don't make people who we are. We allow people with a functioning brain to be whoever they want to be.
Yeah.
So I don't think I should be judging whether or not this technique for depression is a success by whether or not you get a job.
Sure. No, true.
I judge it by whether or not you can make the decision to get a job or to sit in your basement and watch TV, as long as it's your choice.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, even if you take the self-serving notion of, and we certainly struggle with this, how do you have endpoints so that something that works so well in your own lab and with your own patients, and now, you know, across more than, you know, I've worked with many psychiatrists now, so this is not about some magic, the potion that we have some cabal, but that why can't we scale it up? Maybe it's because we take too much ownership of what we do. And that fundamentally is a problem too. We don't own the whole patient. We train that we see a person in all their parts, but our interaction with them isn't everything. And that's a real difference between neurology and psychiatry. And I think that we may be undermining knowing what actually our role is as we try to push envelope on treatments of how to put people in a position to be their best self, because we don't control the world. And I remember when I was at Emory, we went through, you know, the 2008 to 2012 was in the financial collapse. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were over the age of 45 and you lost your job and you're out of work for 3 months, good luck trying to get a new job in your own field. What do you do if you've been sick for 6 years and haven't worked in that long? How do you sell yourself? And now that you're well, I mean, you watch the importance of the therapist. And the patient saw the therapist taught them well. And it took several years for them to realize, no, the device enabled it. So how do you pick your outcome measures when the world is not hospitable? Sure. I've even entertained the idea that maybe the first 6 months you ought to have patients in a work camp. You ought to keep them where you provide the environment so that you don't have the variance of some patients have really supportive families. Some people return to more stress and they awoke to realize that their environment is pretty awful. And there's all those extra noise features that make for a bad experiment, but actually is the real life in which we do these experiments. And we've got to be smart so that we don't lose the ability to have this in our toolkit of treatments for the wrong reason. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But if it does work, which obviously I think that we have evidence that it does, and not just our group, but other groups. But how do we maximize how to use it? Because the world is a tough place.
Someone said that, you know, DBS for depression only works if Helen Myberg does it. And it was meant in a good way, because it is a tough problem and you need a good patient selection and you need a team that can do it and the experience and so on. So you talked about scaling it up, and exactly these outcome measures make it much more complex, as in tremor, where you just have, you know, direct evidence on videotape.
So on one hand, I'm not trashing that. Look, it's the most fundamental thing, you explain most of the variance. So some people think we have some magic of how we pick patients that we cherry pick. There's a machine learning algorithm that good psychiatrists that have worked in this have learned what the phenotype is. Now, everybody wants phenotypes. No one says they're cherry picking for cancer when you do a receptor marker and you only give a drug to people who have that receptor marker. I consider that really great psychiatrists, of which I've had the privilege to work with many, have learned what the phenotype is that this SCC-DBS works on. And they select for it. And so they get better because we pick the right group of these resistant patients. On the other hand, we get people to remission. And then there's noise of real life on top of it. So I don't have a problem with needing new scale. I think that, even if you don't know the right patients to, you can follow inclusion criteria. And we study ECT failures without comorbidity that are mostly melancholic. The most important variable is getting it in the right spot. And in our own group, even with experienced people, that explained most of the variance. And if that's, you know, one of the things I always like to bring up in my talks is we've got three variables that lead to failure. The psychiatrists blame the surgeon, say you didn't do the surgery right. The surgeons blame the psychiatrist and say you didn't give me the right patient. And three is, well, it's a lousy scale and why are we using some, you know, ancient, you know, endpoint that measures too many things. You kind of look at what variables can you change. We're back to my rules of, you know, it's hard, but like, don't die trying on the wrong thing. The one variable I can control right now is if I can figure out where to put it. And a surgeon follows instructions. That is a controllable variable. Finding the phenotype of depression, I spend the rest of my time trying to do that. That's almost a lost cause. Even when you find a marker, nobody wants to use it, and getting it scaled up is really hard. The endpoints are fine if you actually do a good job on the other two. So I think that understanding this reset switch and providing more evidence of the stages of recovery and which ones the DDS does and which it doesn't is akin in Parkinson's, that look, there are dopamine sensitive behaviors that are substituted by DDS and the SDN. And then there are other parts of the illness that are not touched by that location. So if you want to deal with gait and freezing, that's why people try to look at the PPN or look at some other target. If you really care about non-motor features, it's not going to be doing the best possible job of hitting the lateral STN. You've got to be creative to the full feature space. Depression has got, instead of saying, oh, it's too complicated, it's heterogeneous. No, it has modules. It has discernible features. Which one are you in when you're in the SCC? And which ones are you not in? And then maybe you can come to understand which features are less affected, and then maybe be picking different targets to different phenotypes. But there's a logic that's no different for this than there is for neurology. And neurology doesn't necessarily do such a good job either. They get to try to get better and better at the part they were already pretty good at. And so again,
freezing of gait, and you're right. There are a lot of things that we can't modulate well these days.
So I think it's figuring out the problem you can solve and not over ruminating on the whole picture. I mean, I think that's just kind of being an adult. And I think the patient's needs kind of guide those decision trees experimentally.
So what do you think needs to be done for this, for the future? Like, what are the things that we need to do as a field to make this more mainstream, more robust? And
so I think that, psychiatry, and I think you're part of this solution. I think anyone doing imaging and tractography now, that's become kind of a mainstream, that you need to understand this, not in the abstract, that to have guidance of how you implant, because you actually embrace a full circuit structure and the complexity of it. And I think people are doing that in the conversations, but it's not enough to just say it's complicated and we're kind of in there, but to get granular, because at least in our experience, I mean, the surgeon didn't believe it until we proved it, that a millimeter could make a difference. Do I think, and again, we lucked out that we at least have differences in the DTI maps to generate some hypotheses. Do I think it's as simple as you're in or out of the circuit? No, because there's a lot of overlap. But that lays foundation for figuring out the nuances. And that becomes it's sort of like feature selection in machine learning. You can throw in every data point if you're Amazon or Google and just machine learn the universe, and I don't know, patterns or things will pop out that maybe you didn't even know you cared about. In this space, feature selection with smaller samples is where you have to go. And so I think that knowing that there's an anatomy, informed by work like Suzanne Heber, and actually taking ground truth and then looking to see what part of it can I resolve with the tools we have, which you and I know we don't have the luxury of what you can do in a non-human primate track tracing experiment, but that one can reverse engineer to know what you do and then test prospectively. It's got to be iterative. And I think the fields are now moving there with anybody doing DDS, particularly in psychiatry, and even in neurology, that tractography is important as an MRI as important as unit reportings. And that I think that's a start. I think that people, again, also need to balance between, if you don't get 100%, you don't throw it away.
Sure.
And that, and you don't say, oh, well, I'll build another better mousetrap. I'll pretend you don't know anything and just start from ground zero doing something else.
Yeah.
If you have no finding, then of course you need to do that and give up on what you thought was your own good idea.
Yeah.
But if you actually are close, but not to the finish line, it's actually not a race. So it isn't like go home. It's not the Olympics where you were fourth, you don't make the team. No, you try again and you learn from your mistakes. You don't grind in and say, well, we were right and you were wrong,
yeah,
or I respect you. And that's back again to nobody's right all the time. This is war against a disease. This is not a competition against each other. And how do we take what we've learned, and same for me, to listen to where evidence-based criticism is and said, I bet if you did this, it would be better.
Yeah.
And do what it takes to try to do it again.
Yeah.
And make iterations that don't change too many variables at the same time.
Makes sense.
But to do it again. Because, and I think it would be a personal failing, but I'd let it go that it would be a personal failing if what I do was not available.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I can change my email address. I don't have a listed phone number. I'll deal with the fact that people write from all over the world who are suffering and want to know, who think it's a treatment, how can they get it,
yeah,
where can I send them? The desperation that one has to listen to that I don't ask for, considering I don't have a clinical practice.
Yeah.
I get this, all the time. And you have to have no frontal lobe to not be empathetic to this kind of suffering and to have people think that you can solve it. I don't pretend that I can solve, the world's problems. But to know what I know and not be able to get it to a finish line is to live that your experiments are your experiments. You do the best you can. But if you want it to be for real, you have to have partners. And those partners are industry. And we have to influence industry to do it again, whether or not we have to give them evidence.
Yeah.
And then we have to make them realize it's important. And there are lots of ways to do that. But they have... But that's come... I will be able, I would like to have a chapter end where I felt we gave it another shot.
Yeah.
And that hopefully will happen.
Yeah.
As I think the data wants it. And the community should work to see that be successful,
yeah,
and to help it be successful. And I think that's true for depression. I think that's true for these other disorders,
yeah,
and
yeah,
we can work together to do that.
It's so fascinating to me personally, if you have only one patient in which you see a true effect, and I'm sure you have seen such patients where, you're sure this works for this patient, then that is proof that it will work. It's maybe, it won't maybe work for everybody, and it might, the target might have been lucky in this one and unlucky in the other one and so on.
What's interesting, I particularly as the papers have evolved and, everybody, I feel like it's the Greek chorus in an ancient, theater where, each side is, laying commentary all the time.
Yeah.
You'll watch patients respond in blogs, when the industry trial failed, people saying, oh yeah, we knew it didn't work. And then other patients going, well, it worked for me.
Yeah.
And am I not entitled? And the ethical discussions about what's good enough, if something is safe, should you have access? What is the bar? What does it mean to be a patient with a device that is working and knowing that other people don't have access?
Yeah.
And there's a powerlessness in that also. But I think every clinician, placebo effects are profound in many situations.
Yeah.
We have an ongoing naturalistic test that this is not placebo, because when a device breaks or a battery dies and the patient hasn't checked it, and you replace the battery and fix the device after you've lost the effect and you regain it.
Yeah.
If on the front side you can't prove it's not placebo, that's a true statement because you haven't done the experiment, but you have the naturalistic experiment, I'm done. That's not... The That's not how we should be spending our time arguing about if it's real.
Yeah.
We should be spending our time about, is it worth it? You know, there's discussions about, well, it's a first world treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But if we can understand what we've done in these intractably ill people to get them better and keep them better, it will teach us something so fundamental about what depression is that it will scale in a different direction to other parts of how we treat depression. So while now it is a first world treatment, and I can't control that, but I can work to have fundamental understanding so it could move to be non-invasive, or we could learn something that could be leveraged in another way. But to do that in the absence of understanding these clues would really be a missed opportunity.
Great. Thank you so much, Helen, for this great opportunity to talk with you.
Well, you know, it's very, it keeps me going to know that people are interested. And I know I get a lot of reinforcement from the patients, but in fact, this is a privileged position, and this has been really fun, and I hope I can continue to make something, you know, meaningful contributions, because the...
Thank you for listening to Stimulating Brains.